Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to discuss the landscape of jihadist violence in Nigeria and the emergence of what has been described in the media as a new group called the Mahmouda Group. I'm joined by our returning guest, James Barnett. James is one of our fellows and currently a PhD candidate at Oxford University. James is also a non-resident research fellow at Hodgson Institute, based in Washington, D.C. James specializes in conflict and geopolitics in sub-Saharan Africa, including many, many other roles. James, it's always a pleasure to have you come on the show, and I look forward to our conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much, Michael. Thanks for having me back for a third time.
Yeah, brilliant. Let's start off with this. So there's been a report in the news that is there's a new group that has emerged, and I think it's based in the middle belt of Nigerian Kwara State, I believe. Can you tell us about this group and how long it's been operating and its configuration and all of that?
Yeah. Thanks, Michael. So you're referring, I guess, to the Sahara Reporter's article, I think, a few weeks back about the so-called Mahmouda Group that started kind of generating some buzz on social media and stuff. So I guess for context here, right, I've spent the past several years looking a good bit at the diffusion of jihadist groups from kind of northeastern Nigeria as they try to establish cells in the Northwest and the Middle Belt. As you say, I've written kind of two studies on this topic in the past with colleagues, and then presently I'm in the process of working on a third one. And actually, I've been in Nigeria for the better part of the past year, doing a lot of field work in these regions and stuff. So we're presently kind of working on kind of our most updated assessment that includes an assessment of this network, the Mahmouda Group, which I'll talk a bit more about in a minute. But I include all of this as a kind of a disclaimer, because this is still kind of research in progress. I think I want to be careful not to necessarily overstate what we know at this stage, because when you're in the fieldwork stage, you get a lot of reports. Sometimes they're contradictory and stuff. There's the fog of war, so to speak. And I don't want to say something now that then in a few months when we publish something, we'll be correcting ourselves. And also, if I tell you everything, I know now.
Yeah, that's too much to read.
exactly. Especially this younger generation that just does podcasts and doesn't read academic articles and reports.
I agree.
So I mean, what I can say for now, and I tweeted about this I think a week or so ago, just kind of briefly. So this so-called kind of Mahmouda group is not necessarily new per se. I think there's actually a lot of similarities in some ways to this other so-called new group, the Lakurawa, as they're referred to locally, that have been operating in Sokoto and Kebbi State, and since kind of like November of last year, November 2024, thereabouts, also generated a lot of media attention. And I think in both cases, neither of the groups are new. We actually, we know that they've been operating in those regions in one capacity or another for several years. And I think that the labels can sometimes be a bit misleading, or at least kind of capture the fact that there's still a lot of uncertainty about these groups and stuff. But what's interesting also is that between this, the Lakurawa and the so-called Mahmouda group, what we're seeing is that I think, you know, the broader point is that the kind of jihadist networks and landscape in Nigeria are not kind of simply just divided between, like, you know, the JAS or JASDJ faction of Boko Haram and ISWAP. That the conflict is actually a bit complex, but it's in some ways it's kind of always been that way. And I can talk a bit about this with the so-called Mamuda group, because there are some really interesting historical antecedents. So the Mamuda group is known locally as Darussalam. Mamuda is the name of the commander who supposedly commands it. Sahara reporters got a hold of an audio of his that I've also heard, where, you know, he's addressing these local communities in Kwara State, as you noted, you know, kind of essentially threatening them with a coming conflict. But his group has actually been operating around parts of Niger State, particularly the kind of Kainji Park area in western Niger State, a bit closer to the border with Benin, and then parts of northern Kwara State for several years. So, you know, there's even kind of a whole stretch of that whole kind of Kainji, you know, forest reserve area. It extends into Kwara State, into particularly the kind of area around Kayama. You know, the forest extends into effectively Old Oyo National Park in Oyo State in the southwest. So this is kind of a big kind of stretch of geography, stretch of land we're talking about in central Nigeria. And the group has actually been out there for since about 2020 or 2021. We've heard reports of this group coming in. And originally they were more focused on proselytization, what they call Dawa. So that's their kind of preaching to get people to join the group, saying, you know, we reject the government is sinful, the government is un-Islamic, you know, certainly propagating that, you know, kind of what looks like a Salafi jihadist ideology, or at the very least what you could call a rejectionist ideology. And here there's some kind of historical precedent that's worth discussing. But they weren't necessarily engaged in the same kind of intensity of conflict as, you know, say, of course, the, you know, JAS or ISWAP in the Northeast, in terms of kind of a real active insurgency against the military. And then, of course, there was also a lot of kind of ambiguity about the relationship between Mamuda's group and local bandits. You know, the other kind of key piece of context here is that banditry has really become the dominant security challenge in northwestern and most of north central Nigeria in the past you know, 5 to 10 years, depending on how you look at it. So one thing that I've written about quite a bit in the past is kind of this nexus between jihadists and bandits. That's actually a much more kind of complicated and fraught nexus than we might assume. You know, I think the jihadists, they have often tried to come in and recruit bandits to their cause, because these bandits, I mean, even that name might be a bit misleading to some listeners who are kind of not familiar with the Nigerian or maybe the West African context, because these bandits have you know, they're heavily militarized criminal gangs, right? They have, typically they have quite sophisticated, you know, small arms and light weapons. They've become quite adept at doing relatively sophisticated raids, you know, mass kidnapping attacks and stuff. So they're not necessarily just kind of like local criminals, right? They're serious non-state armed groups. And throughout the Northwest, jihadists, you know, JAS, ISWAP, the Ansaru faction, all these different groups have kind of tried at different points to recruit bandits to their cause. Some commanders, some networks have had a bit more success than others, but there's also always been tension. Even the commanders, and discussing this in an academic article wrote with colleagues that we've recently submitted, that even the commander that's had the most success in the Northwest, kind of co-opting, or I should say collaborating with bandits, he's also had a lot of issues with those same bandits recently. So it's a very fluid environment. But what we're seeing also with the Darussalam group is it becomes, when you're looking at local reports from Niger State, and I should really specify kind of the western part of Niger State, again, around that Kainji axis, not so much in the kind of Shiroro Bida axis in the eastern part of the state, where you have other sets of jihadist actors and bandits operating. But if you look at the reports from this part of Niger State or Kwara State, you know, you really have to hone in specifically and kind of look through the data and you know, talk to local contacts and stuff to get a sense of, you know, what's happening there. Is it banditry? Is it this Darussalam group? Is it a bit of both, right? So, you know, both because the Darussalam and, you know, jihadist groups kind of, they use similar modus operandi as bandits, but in some cases they also recruit bandits into their gangs. In other cases, people confuse, you know, they don't necessarily know the difference between a bandit and a jihadist. They're not, you know, kind of really interacting with them in certain manners. So all to say that, you know, this group has kind of been operating for several years in that region in different ways. In recent months, it had been kind of coming into contact more with different, local vigilante groups. And so that's really, if you look at the Sahara Reporter's article about this, you know, it's essentially what was issued was a warning or a threat by the commander of this group to the local communities saying, you know, if you don't play ball with us, if you keep raising these vigilantes, if the vigilantes are fighting us, then we'll go to war with you, right? Whereas if you don't have the vigilantes, you know, what they're claiming is we've tried to, preach to you. We've not interfered with your, you know, with your kind of communities and stuff. You're the ones bothering us. We've not been the ones bothering you. In reality, of course, you know, they are a source of insecurity. There's been banditry. They've, abducted traditional rulers and stuff. But, you know, in their own telling, in their own propaganda, they see themselves as kind of the victims. So that's the recent context for this audio. So essentially, you know, there have actually been audios over the years that circulated. But this one, you know, the media managed to get a hold of. And so it kind of, that's what created this new narrative in the media that there's this new jihadist group, right? So on the question of, is it a new group or is it an old group? I think this is where we need to be a bit careful because the answer is it's maybe a bit of both, right? If you go back to this, you know, if you look at the past two studies we've written on this topic, there's been a sect called Dar es Salaam, and I use that term specifically, a sect called Dar es Salaam that's been present in Niger State since at least 2000, if not probably maybe even the 1990s. But originally the sect, you know, as far as we can tell, it was, and again, this is something we detail more in some kind of forthcoming studies, you could classify it as kind of rejectionist. It was, you know, it was reclusive, right? It withdrew itself from the broader communities, from the broader Nigerian society, but it wasn't kind of instigating a violent jihad, at least in Niger State at that time, in say the 2000s. But the group was expelled from Niger State in 2009. There was some contemporary media reporting. You can look at a few other Nigerian security analysts have also kind of, you know, written about that 2009 expulsion. And then you hear about the group, nothing was kind of heard about the group in public, at least until 2020, when there were these reports that the group resurfaced in Nasarawa State, particularly in Toto local government area, which is just south of the FCT, Federal Capital Territory. And at this point, you know, the group was kind of being described as, well, it's a violent insurgent movement. The military, when they came in and raided the Dar es Salaam camp, they said that they found all these explosive devices and stuff. The actual history and trajectory of Dar es Salaam is quite complex, and getting verified information on it is difficult. And I know this because I've been searching for 4 years. But essentially, you know, and here again, I'll be kind of vague as we kind of work on hashing out the specifics. And I think, you know, putting forward a stronger hypothesis in our research. But I think that, you know, it's my assessment now is that while the group did form as kind of a rejectionist sect and stuff, there probably were some earlier linkages to Boko Haram than I think have previously, you know, that then maybe we haven't really kind of realized in the past. And again, I've collected some data and I'm trying to kind of, you know, make this a bit of a final.
Makes sense of it.
But, you know, that there is probably more of an overlap or more of a history of members of Dar es Salaam intersecting with those more in the Boko Haram orbit. Though it's very important to remember, right? When we talk about Boko Haram, what do we even mean, right? What is a label? You know, Muhammad never called his movement that, right? You know, they refer to themselves as Yusuf and stuff. And Boko Haram had its own early factions, right? You had the Kanama Taliban led by Muhammad Ali, you know, a one-time kind of associate of Muhammad Yusuf, who then split off in 2002, 2003. So, you know, between 2003 and say 2009, when the Boko Haram insurgency started in earnest, like you also had these other factions that were already out there. You had the Taliban faction. We still don't kind of have a full history of, you know, whether they fully kind of separated or maybe some of them reintegrated back into Yusuf's movement and stuff. And then, of course, after 2009, it also gets quite complex. You have, you know, you have the Ansaru faction emerging around 2010, 2011. There's still, you know, a lot of scholars kind of debate about, you know, what do we actually know about early Ansaru as opposed to just kind of speculation. And then even, you know, recently interviewing some very senior defectors, kind of early members of the movements, they also referred to other commanders earlier on who also kind of defected from Boko Haram, from Abu Bakr Shekau early on, but didn't, you know, necessarily join Ansaru and stuff, right? So I think that, you know, one of the key points, so like, I'm not going to say right here, oh, you know, this is Mahmouda's group. He was this guy in Boko Haram, you know, 5 years ago, and then before that, he was Darul Salam. There's still a lot of uncertainty. But I think that one thing that is coming clear and is coming through in our research is really kind of, it's important to remember, and I'll wrap up here so we can move on to other questions, but maybe this can segue into kind of broader conversation. It's kind of the importance of really personal connections and the relationships between individual commanders and stuff, right? So like right now, we don't necessarily know, you know, there's some theories, some speculation that Mahmouda's group may have pledged bayah to another organization, but I don't actually have any clear evidence of that. I think it's also quite possible it's operating independently. And then if you look at the people around that group and elsewhere, you know, kind of the more I look at the movement of these jihadists into northwestern and north central Nigeria, I think that, well, you know, we don't want to forget, you know, it's not like that there's no utility in referring to, okay, this is JAS, this is ISWAP, this is Ansaru. Sometimes that, you know, those labels do mean something. Sometimes we are talking about pretty coherent organizations with their own, you know, so-called Akida, their internal creed and stuff, their ideology. But what we also see is that there's a lot of, you know, the individual commanders in the jihadist sphere have a lot of autonomy, especially when they're moving outside the Northeast into these other regions that are kind of less populated by other jihadists, where they have maybe a bit more room to maneuver. They have a lot of autonomy, that some of these guys have maybe been in multiple factions at different stages throughout history, that or even if they've not been in different factions, they take in people from different factions. So I think that there is a degree of fluidity here that is important to stress, you know, and that's, again, we're working on giving kind of a more refined assessment, but I also, I think that there's value now in coming out and discussing this, because a lot of the media narrative now is like, oh, there's some new jihadist group that just popped up in Niger or a state. And actually, the evidence indicates that this is a broader, there's been this kind of 20-year growing jihadist milieu in Nigeria with all these different regional and sub-regional variations. And what we're seeing is one manifestation of that, maybe.
Okay. You know, thank you for clarifying that and giving that broad overview. There's so many things that we can talk about here. And I know you and I have talked about, you know, this in our kind of like work that we're doing. And I know we've had a little bit of back and forth in terms of what this means. But I can see that you're clearly even agreeing with some of the things I have mentioned. So let's start off with the intersectionality in between crime and ideology. Because what you've mentioned here is that we have the local bandits in the Northwest. So we see, again, whilst you talk about that, I wanted to talk about the topography, because we've done a very good job. You know, sometimes we look at people talking about the Northeast, but it looks like the Northwest is now the hotspot. It looks like the theater of where the conflict is, and it's now coming to the Middle Belt. But from what you're saying, it's always been where we've, over the years, we've looked at the Northwest. I remember in over 10 years ago, when I was doing my own research, I remember I did some interviews in Kwara. And you remember early on as well, Boko Haram was kind of like extended towards Kwara, maybe they had cells in there. Because I've heard that this Mahmouda, from another scholar, says Mahmouda is an offshoot or some of Boko Haram as well. So it could also be some of the cells, old cells from there. So like Riley said, there are connections. So now what I want you to kind of like unpack is this. When we look at this intersection between groups that typically you think they're ideological, you know, you're saying they're doing call to worship, they're challenging, they're basically ideological, basically, you know, Islamic, basically that. And then you see them also collaborating or cooperating with criminal organizations that are like, you know, like bandits. So how do you define such relations? Will you call it like more transactional, pragmatic relationship, or does that also undermine or brings to question the ideology in mm-hmm. the ideological, which, you know, you and I have had this, you know, in private, yeah. whether these groups are basically, are they ideological, or does ideology provide just the right framework for them to, and then yeah. not necessarily, I wouldn't have to be, no fairness, I wouldn't say, I wouldn't dismiss the ideology, but does it in a way provide, and then again, you mentioned, and I'm saying that as well, because you also mentioned the relevance of the commander's personal relationship, personal connections, and all of this stuff. Because mm-hmm. if we're talking about ideology, that shouldn't matter too much. The ideology should supersede all of those personal stuff. So how do you unpack all of this intersections of secular ideology connections? And then again, lastly, what is the common denominator? There must be a common denominator for them to be able to even collaborate. Mm-hmm. And you know, so what is the common denominator?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, let me start with the ideology question and then come back to the common denominator later. I think, you know, so I'm not someone to downplay ideology. I think that ideology is actually quite important, in not just in Islamist movements, but, you know, I edit a journal called Current Trends in Islamist Ideology. So, you know, I'm interested in that topic, but not just in Islamist movements. I mean, in politics, right? My own country's, I don't, you know, spend as much time in the US as I used to, but my own country's politics, from what I can tell in the news and stuff, is quite ideological. Exactly. So I'm, you know, I'm not one person to downplay ideology, but I do think that it's not, you know, ideology is not a static, ossified thing. Like, okay, you have the JAS Akita, you have the ISWAP Akita, you have the Ansaru Akita. You know, they overlap in 60% of ideological tenets, but then there's 40% disagreement. So, you know, you can kind of predict they can never really work together. That's not really what it looks like, right? And you have to take in, look at kind of the micro, the meso, and the macro levels of this, right? And so that's where I think this idea of looking at kind of the meso level, right? And the micro level is important too, right? If you're talking about kind of, you know, the perspectives of individual foot soldiers, why they join jihadist groups, you know, which jihadist groups they join. It's interesting. I mean, I was recently interviewing a lot of defectors in Maiduguri from relatively low level to very senior. And you see a real mix where, you know, there are people that sometimes they'd move between JAS, ISWAP, JAS, you know, Bakura back to ISWAP. Sometimes they had very little agency. Sometimes it really, you know, the way they recounted it, it really was like forces outside their control. And then other times I'd find, even with relatively, you know, low ranking commanders, a degree of like, oh, actually, I was thinking about, you know, which, how the group treats its fighters, how the group treats civilians. That made me want to switch to this group. So it's, you know, it's all incredibly complex, right? And I think you're going to get different answers if you're looking at, like, you know, the very senior commanders, including a lot of the early Yusufiya guys versus a more recent generation of jihadists versus, you know, the foot soldiers in any given region who may not have as much agency in this, right? Who might be kind of forced or kind of conscripted into the insurgency. So I think that, you know, in terms of that, you know, so I know that's not a perfectly satisfactory answer, but, you know, the reality is that it's quite complex. I think that, you know, what we certainly see is that when jihadists come into the Northwest, for the most part, at least the big groups that I've been following, and, you know, there might be, again, because there is a lot of fog of war here, I do know of certain specific incidents of jihadists just kind of leaving their jihadist credentials and joining bandit gangs, but it's very hard for me to quantify. Right. So there are some cases where the jihadists just say, you know, look, I'm a soldier for fortune. I was killing in the name of jihad and now I'm just, but, you know, I don't really believe in that or whatever. I'm just going to do it for myself. I'm out for the money. I'm out for survival. But it's very hard for me to quantify, like, is that, you know, the majority of jihadists that are relocating? And I do want to specify, you know, all the evidence indicates that, you know, the locus point of jihadist violence in Nigeria is still the Northeast. The Northwest and the North Central, the predominant security issues are kind of banditry, the farmer herder, intercommunal conflict, all that stuff. Yeah. But the jihadists are, you know, they're making inroads in different ways. So, you know, in terms of if we accept that probably the, you know, okay, maybe some jihadists are just kind of defecting entirely from that insurgency and becoming, you know, full-on bandits. What I also see, you know, what I see in my research is that a lot of them aren't, right? I mean, I've interviewed jihadists who were operating in the Northwest before they defected to the government, all that stuff. And, you know, what they describe is an organization that is still, you know, very much in its MO, you know, it is still ideological. It follows to differing degrees, kind of, you know, the guidance from the broader organization, be it the JAS leadership in the Northeast or in the case of like Ansaru, you know, the kind of regional Al-Qaeda leadership and stuff. But what we also see is that in the Northwest, you need to be very pragmatic, right? In the North Central, if you're a jihadist, because these groups there, they don't have the same amount of manpower in the Northeast. They're mostly strangers, right? Especially if we're looking at, you know, those who are kind of ethnic Kanuris, or like, you know, Sadiku, the leader of this JAS outfit in the Northwest, is reportedly an ethnic Babur. So again, from the Northeast, these are people who don't necessarily know the Northwest as well as, say, the local bandits. And the bandits are more numerous. The bandits are very much rooted in the communities. You know, in many instances, the bandits have become the de facto rulers of rural communities. That's a whole separate line of research I'm doing with some colleagues that should be out soon. So, you know, the jihadists have to be, there's this kind of fine line they play between like, okay, well, you need to preserve, you know, they still need to kind of, you know, maintain a lot of their kind of, you know, their ideology, some of their precepts, you know, they have certain red lines and stuff, you know, that they won't cross or they won't compromise on. They still have these organizational affinities that really matter, when, especially when factional fighting is really tense, we say between JAS and ISWAP. But at the same time, they're operating in a very different environment. And so they end up being a lot more pragmatic for the most part, which also means that they, in some ways, that can kind of dilute their jihadist religious credentials. So like one of the interesting things that I think I've seen in the past few years of looking at this is that, you know, pretty much every jihadist group, whether it's JAS under Sadiku, whether it's ISWAP, whether it's this Dar al Salaam, these Lakhurawa groups, you know, this is something we'll be detailing, you know, more before long, but pretty much all of these groups simultaneously or maybe alternately employ both kind of carrots and sticks with bandits, right? So all of these groups, you can find at least some instances where they cooperate with the bandits, where they work with them, even at the risk of kind of diluting their jihadist credentials, undermining their own kind of religious image by working with these local warlords who are, you know, terrorizing the Muslim majority communities in the Northwest. But then at the same time, they all inevitably fight with some bandits as well. And sometimes they fight in a way that's kind of, you know, for almost propagandistic or reasons, like when Ansaru was fighting bandits in 2022 in Kaduna, 2021 and 2022, they were really broadcasting it in their propaganda because they wanted to show, say, oh, look, these local warlords are terrorizing local Muslims. We're defending the Muslims against these warlords. But then Ansaru was also cooperating with bandits at the same time. So all the groups do. In some instances, we even hear, you know, we've heard from some recent interviews that, like, the certain jihadist commanders don't allow their soldiers, their fighters, to engage in banditry. So the fighters will go and pay bandits to do kidnappings and then share the ransoms with that. You know, so it's like they're trying to keep themselves at arm's length in some ways, but at the same time, they're also trying to tap into this very lucrative conflict economy in the Northwest. And so I think that, you know, to bring it back to the question of Dar al-Salaam, for example, you know, one thing that has become clear is that when I say that there's kind of, there's some possible or likely kind of collaboration and movement of some elements of Dar al-Salaam to Boko Haram, that's not been complete though, because we have, you know, there are testimonials from former members of these groups that also make very clear that some members of Dar al-Salaam rejected JAS. They rejected Muhammad Yusuf, right? And so even though the kind of MO that you saw from Mahmouda's group a few years ago was a bit different from what you kind of from JAS's MO, right? So again, that's where I bring in it, that I don't think the ideology is completely absent, because, you know, Mahmouda really was focused mostly, as I said, on proselytizing for a while, which is something that JAS hasn't really been doing in the Northeast since, I mean, you know, since the Muhammad Yusuf era. They've been very focused on their kind of ultra-violent insurgency and terrorism. So I think that, you know, I think I painted quite a complex picture, but I think that that's really important for recognizing that it's not either or. It's like Yes, the the personal relationships between commanders and their, you know, their ethnic identities. You see a lot of this in the North Central. Again, we'll have more kind of details on that soon. But, you know, certain commanders can swap between groups, but because they share the same ethnicity and they studied at the same madrasa, you know, it's easy. So, like, yes, all of that matters. But I don't think you can also seriously look at the range of violence being conducted by actors that we would call jihadist in Nigeria today and say, oh, this is all the same. Like, there's no difference between what they're doing. Or say, oh, you know, there's nothing. It's all just criminality in another vein. Because I think if you look at it, you know, that spectrum, it's
I do agree with you. Like, the it's very complex. You know, you'd be... It would be unhelpful to simplify or take a very simplistic description of that. But one thing you and I will agree upon is that there's been, and you even take it far back to Muhammad, you see, that there's been a decline in the religious credibility of, let me come to jazz and stuff now. So when we look at I was just talking to a young PhD, the PhD student before this podcast, and he wanted me to trace, and I might link her up to you. He wanted me to trace the trajectory of Boko Haram. And I was saying, whereas in the first stage, Muhammad Yusuf, you could see had like strong religious credibility. And like Riley said, there was a lot of dawah, proselytizing, and all of that preaching. We've not seen that from the time of Shekau. And then also the challenge towards Shekau from within the ranks of Boko Haram was also clear. You could see it was, you know, Shekau was, you know, declaring people apostates and all of his positions. Ideologically, they can challenge him. People like Mama No can challenge him. But from even what you say now, even the fight between Jazz and Israel, what is the ideological differences? What are they fighting? So now, once you just focus on the ideological one now, let's talk about Jazz, Israel, and all these ideological ones. What are the ideological differentiations? What are they that is making, especially Jazz and ISWAP? What are they fighting? What is the difference?
So I think that actually there is, you know, there is a pretty strong and major divide in the Jazz and ISWAP ideology. I think that on the reality, like the reality on the ground, can get more complex because neither group is you know, the platonic ideal of the ideology that they're necessarily espousing, because there's, you know, the local pragmatism, the local exigencies, the vagaries of individual commanders and stuff, right? But I do think that there is, you know, there is that difference. I agree with you that, you know, the religious credibility of Boko Haram was severely undermined, you know, when Shekau became leader. Because, you know, Boko Haram was only like an insurgency under Yusuf for the last month of Yusuf's life, essentially, right? The July 2009 uprising. And so when Boko Haram was preaching its, you know, doing its dawah, preaching its ideology, it was a very extreme ideology. It was a very radical one. Certainly not all, you know, Muslims or even most Muslims would have agreed with it. But it was more, you know, quote unquote, mainstream, right? Yes, there was the divides, you know, Sheikh Jafar and a number of the prominent Salafists, you know, became very critical of Boko Haram. But like it was...
But this was still healthy. It was like a healthy debate, you know. Yeah, it was a healthy debate.
Well, I mean, Sheikh Jafar was assassinated.
he didn't turn out healthy eventually, yeah.
it did get violent. But I think that the, you know, the focus on, you know, when Abu Bakr Shekau came, you know, took over, it was just a full insurgency, right? And it was just about, you know, and an ultra-violent, ultra-Takfiri one at that. So, you know, and the majority of Boko Haram's victims, you know, as far as we know, right, you know, they were targeting Muslims, right? If you look at all the bombings they were doing in Maiduguri and stuff, yes, they were intentionally targeting Christians, committed horrific violence against Christians, but like the actual body count, you know, for lack of a better word, right, all these Muslims started dying. And so Boko Haram became, you know, completely, that stuff kind of became completely excised from like the mainstream Islamic discourses in Nigeria. Interestingly, though, one thing that we've started to see in recent years, and I'll get back to the Jazz ISWAP bit, but really just in the past year or so, is the rise of these kind of very radical TikTok preachers. These clerics on TikTok who are, you know, including old clips of Muhammad Yusuf and stuff, right? I mean, it's you know, not so different from maybe the Gen Z or Gen Alpha or whatever it is in the US who, you know, a year ago in TikTok, there were people reading out this Bin Laden's open letter to America, you know, so maybe partially it's this generational thing that they don't, they enough time has passed that these people that were kind of fully ostracized from the mainstream discourse 15, 20 years ago are now kind of creeping back in with the younger generation. But so, you know, I think all of that is important because, you know, none of that means that Boko Haram stopped being ideological, right? I think in Chakal's own mind, he was, you know, waging this, what he thought was the path that he should follow after Muhammad Yusuf. So in his own mind, this was ideology. And, you know, it's just a question of kind of where they lie within the broader kind of religious discourses in the country. In terms of Jazz and ISWAP, I think that the big ideological question, and it was a strategic question as well, but, you know, the two overlap, was this question of the treatment of Muslim civilians, right? Mm. So one of the major factors that led to the split between Boko Haram and Jazz, and it was complex, right? There were multiple factors involved. It happened at a time when Jazz started losing, you know, when the insurgency started losing a lot of its territory, things were becoming harder in the bush. But one of the big things that are the big grievances that a number of Boko Haram commanders had always had against Chakal, and you see this even earlier with the early kind of Ansari split and stuff, is that Chakal had this view that essentially all Muslims, unless they are, you know, fully supporting us and literally coming into Sambisa for us, that they're kafar, right? So that's that ultra takfiri ideology that was, again, you know, infamously, it was too extreme for Abu Bakr Baghdadi and the Islamic State. Yeah. So, you know, one of the key points was that when the insurgency came more into contact with the Islamic State, with ISIS around 2015, what you started getting was, you know, that the commanders under Chakal, some of those who were even involved in handling the communication with ISIS, we're kind of seeing that ISIS, which is this like jihadist, you know, they looked up to as the caliph, right? Again, they saw this as the highest kind of insurgent force or the highest, you know, force for their religion in the world, right? So they really looked up to the Islamic State. They looked up to Abu Bakr Baghdadi. And what they saw was that ISIS was essentially saying, no, that's not really, you know, this is not actually what our, you know, what our ideology permits, right? Particularly stuff like, you know, bombing mosques, you know, wanton attacks on Muslim civilians. Again, in reality, like ISIS has killed tons of Muslims as well, but they're, you know, they kind of have a different, they've had a different strategy around it than Chakal's. And what they were starting to advise and to kind of, you know, what they were making clear in their guidance to the Boko Haram insurgency was that, you know, you guys haven't quite calibrated this. You guys are
sorry to pause you. I was more looking at the post Chakal era, because I've always said that I've always in my analysis, even 10 years ago, that Chakal, even though he was very excessive, that he inadvertently, you know, provides I kind of like predicted that Chakal's killing might open the room for Boko Haram to internationalize. I say that's one of the things I said. But then I said again, it could lead to a situation whereby that Chakal is somehow knowingly keeping the group together in a way, keeping it very local. So, but I'm more talking about post Chakal. What is still the ideology? Does it still exist? If Chakal was that central figure,
I think it does. I think that divide still does exist there. I think perhaps it's not quite as strong as it was in 2016. As I said, you know, what we've seen that ISWAP has also killed, you know, Muslim civilians in the Northeast in recent years. Last year, there was that horrible massacre in Yobe State. But I think, you know, there, if you will, the threshold is almost higher in ISWAP than it is in JAS, right? In terms of kind of targeting civilians as opposed to targeting the military. It's targeting civilians. What we've seen from like the Ali Ngulde faction of JAS operating around the Mandara Mountains area, right, is like last year, you know, when they conducted a number of suicide bombings in Gwoza and some other areas, you know, that almost seemed like it was a hearkening back to the Chacao days of, we're just killing people because we can to show you that we're here, right? Whereas ISWAP doesn't really do that if it's Muslims you're talking about. You know, if it's the Muslim population in the Northeast, Christians is, again, a different matter, because the Islamic State ideology makes absolutely no, you know, I mean, it's genocidal when it comes to, you know, dealing with non-Muslim religions. But so I do think it's there. But it's also true that kind of on the ground, you know, the commanders are, right, I've heard reports that some ISWAP commanders extort civilians more than others, right? And so it doesn't neatly, I think that sometimes, and especially this is an easy challenge to fall into when you're kind of relying on desk research, is like, okay, well, we know that ISWAP has this ideology. This is the ideology they publicized. When ISWAP talks about the reasons for the split, you know, that book that Abu Musab al-Barnawi, or that the, published in 2018 internally, you know, like, okay, this is the justification they give for the split. So this is how ISWAP operates, and this is how JAS operates. What you find when you're in the region, when you're interviewing people from the communities and stuff, is that the reality is more complex, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't just say ISWAP doesn't extort Muslim civilians, they tax them, and JAS extorts civilians more like bandits. Well, but you'll find some ISWAP commanders who locals will refer to as bandits. And then you'll also see that in some places, you know, particularly around Lake Chad, JAS has become actually a bit more, you know, a bit more conscious of its image than it was under Chacao, that they've tried to regulate their extortion, you know, as a formal form of taxation. So I'm not saying it's a perfect divide, but I do think broadly, if you look at the operations, the activities of the two factions, you know, defined broadly, you do still see some difference. And again, that also, it's ideology, but it's also strategy. You know, ISWAP also takes, I think, a lot of the propaganda value that it generates for the Islamic State broadly is in this idea, you know, that like, oh, there are still Islamic State fighters who are capable of attacking the military, like a military. Because if you look at Islamic State, you know, a lot of the other provincial affiliates these days, they're not really as strong. They're not able to kind of do the big attacks that they did back then. So when ISWAP attacks, you know, a military outpost and burns an MRAP like they did, you know, just I think this past weekend, you know, it can be ideologically explained insofar as ISWAP is saying, well, we're not Muslims, but it's also part of their strategy. Yeah. So
let me talk about, because we're coming to. So because of time, I'll allow you just conclude on this. I just two questions. So the first question would be, the first question would be, how much control, how much understanding, and how much does the Nigerian state have a grip of this? So if we look at in the last, from the split till now, we've seen that they've definitely, the Nigerian military of the United States have benefited from this internal split between JAS and ISWAP. They've been immensely. We've seen a lot of people have defected to either the Borno State or the federal government's amnesty program. So again, I want to say how much. But again, we've also seen recent attacks that it looks like a lot of people now is talking about resurgence. You know, where we're seeing near frequent attacks. So how much are they losing ground? Why are they losing that? The grand they've made, I mean, the Nigerian states, that would be number one. And how do you see, because again, we see the Borno State government as well lamenting and saying Boko Haram is, you know, the state government has said Boko Haram is resurging and everybody's, you know, worrying that this could be, we might be seeing Boko Haram getting to that state it was during this peak period. So I wanted to comment on that and then look at it more broadly in terms of the second question would then be, what is the end point? What do you see these groups from the Northwest to the Northeast? How do you see these transforming? What is going to happen? Is ISWAP and JAS, are they going to combine? Are they going to, is the infighting going to stop? What's going to happen? What's going to be the next stage of the transformation? Yeah. And then with what we're seeing also in the Middle Belt and in the, to me, it looks like, if you ask me, I would say there is, if you ask me, and I've always mentioned this to you, I would say But let me know. You're the guest. I'll let you talk. I'll let you just talk. Just look at the question and tell me the broad outlook. What's going to happen and what the Nigerian state is doing so far? They're losing ground, and what do they need? What do they need to do to be in control?
Mm-hmm. So I feel like you're setting me up to give these big rambling answers because you're asking these big broad questions. So all my answers have been quite long so far. On the first point, you know, how much does the Nigerian state grasp this? I mean, it's important to recognize that the Nigerian state is not a monolith, right? You have various institutions, you know, the military and the DSS, for example, you know, they coordinate, they cooperate and stuff, but they have slightly different, you know, they have different institutional mindsets. They look at a problem differently. Mm-hmm. You know, they go about intelligence gathering differently, and you know, they exploit their intelligence differently, right? Talk more of the other security agencies, and you know, talk more of the political elite in Abuja, if you will, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. You know, the politicians and all of that. So I think that they're, you know, belatedly the Nigerian state, you know, different elements of the Nigerian state, let's say like the Nigerian security sector, you know, principally the military and the intelligence services have become, I think they have a much better picture of Boko Haram and its internal factions and divisions than they used to. They don't always kind of let on to that, right? It was only a few years ago that the military ever referred to ISWAP. I think in like 2018, 2019, they still, it's all just Boko Haram, right? They're terrorists. Mm-hmm. We're killing them. Don't worry about it. That was kind of the narrative. And so it's only recently that they've kind of cut the military in the past few years has started talking more about, okay, well, yes, you know, we recognize there are different factions and, you know, then, and this adds a bit of complexity to it, right? It becomes complicated when you have these new groups, like the so-called new groups, La Kurawa or the Mamuda group. You know, I don't think that they, you know, especially for groups with foreign connections like La Kurawa, I think that there's still more work that needs to be done, you know, including like in Abuja to really try to kind of understand the regional picture. And that's complicated. Again, in the case of La Kura, it's complicated now by the deterioration in relations between ECOWAS and the Alliance of the Sahel States over the past 2 years, the AES. So, you know, I think that they... understanding the problem epistemologically, if you will, like, or epistemically, I think that there's been some progress made, but there's still more to be done, especially as the conflict becomes more complex and splinters. In terms of, you know, whether the government is gaining or losing ground, I mean, I think one problem I have with, you know, I think you always need to take what the government is saying with a grain of salt, whether it's positive or negative. Right. Because I mean, when I was in my degree a few months ago, the narrative was, oh, the insurgency is almost over, you know, that everyone's surrendering, all that stuff. And, you know, it reminds me of the fact that like every, you know, like the chief of army staff or the defense, you know, the GHQ spokesperson, every one of them since Jonathan has at one point or another said Boko Haram is defeated. And, you know, to me, that's just very short-sighted because insurgencies aren't defeated overnight, right? Yeah. They linger. They're tough. Even in the best case scenarios, like they're not, this isn't something that's solved overnight. So it's always felt like when the governments, you know, or the, and again, you have to recognize that it's different. Elected politicians, you know, an elected governor does not necessarily always have the same interests as the military. And so their narrative on what's happening can be very different from that of, say, you know, a broader institution like the military. But I think that, you know, part of the problem in the last year or two was just that there was actually a lot more violence in the Northeast happening a lot of it wasn't getting reported because it was in very rural areas. And the official narrative was that things are going well, things are working. And, I, you know, I'm actually sympathetic to a lot of kind of like the Borno model and stuff like that. I think the DDR stuff has been one of the big improvements in the Northeast over the past 5 or 10 years. But, you know, just as a basic strategic communications kind of, you know, perspective, it's like if you overpromise, you always risk underdelivering. So even if things, even if the trend line is improving, if you're acting like it's all going perfectly and everything's about to become better, you're going to set people up for disappointment. And then likewise, I think that kind of the shift we've seen coming specifically from the Borno state government in the last month or two, I think that, you know, you also have to, right, there are lots of different factors at play here, right? There's the relationship between the state government and the federal government. You know, there's the question sometimes with governors, when they want more security resources, they hype up a threat, you know, or they overstate it. So I'm not saying that, you know, things aren't bad. I think that the last few attacks do show that the problem is still really there. And I think that, you know, ISWAP is coming. I think the recent use of drones as, you know, FPV drones for actual like kinetic purposes rather than just for, you know, propaganda or ISR purposes, I think that is a concerning development. You know, we're seeing more, it seems like, again, I don't have perfect data on this, but it does seem like we're maybe seeing more IEDs on the roads than we used to, than we were a couple of years ago. So like, I think that, you know, but you have to, again, think of levels of war. You have the tactical, you have the operational, you have the strategic. My own assessment now is that I don't think that there's necessarily a major strategic shift underway. I think that things probably weren't as, I think that things weren't as good as the official narrative would have suggested 3 months ago. And I think that things also might not be quite as bad as some people are suggesting now. You know, I think, you know, the situation might have gotten a bit worse, right, in recent months. But I don't think that we can say that, you know, we're at risk of a repeat of 2014, you know, where the insurgents overrun the entire region. But again, it's all like, none of this is preordained, right? It's contingent on how the state responds, how the government responds, how the military responds. It is true that the security forces are very, you know, they're quite overstretched, right? The military is involved in a lot of operations outside the Northeast now, all over the Northwest, the North Central, especially with these, you know, the different jihadist cells and networks appearing in the Northwest. You know, you run this risk of kind of this whack-a-mole approach where, you know, okay, you try to hit them there, but it's such a big reason, you know, you kill a few of them, but the others escape, they move somewhere else. And then, you know, a year later, you have reports of a new terrorist group in that state, whereas in fact, it's kind of more of the same.
Wow.
So, I don't think complacency is the answer, but I also don't think panic is the answer at this point, at least.
Yeah, I agree with you. I wish we could have more time. It was always like that with you, you know. We never have enough time to explore these issues. But yes, you answered that one very well, to be honest. I do agree with you. It's some of this is also be a question where it could be alarmist in nature, the way we're describing the recent spike. Or it could also be, in a way, we might also be overstating the sources of this group. But whichever way, like you rightly mentioned, it depends on how we approach these issues. And for me, in conclusion, I don't think the military approach. But you did mention intelligence, right? So you mentioned the DSS and the military and some sort of cooperation, but also institutional differences that can affect. But whatever we look at it, then again, you're talking about the rural absence of government in the rural areas that creates could undermine some of the sources made. But like Riley said, this conflict is big and conflict lingers, right? And some of these things are the things that make conflict linger, because when they are left unattended, they create a room where these conflict groups can go and regroup and then come and launch back. So,
I think that one maybe. Yeah, final point here, because I think you raised that correctly, right, about the intelligence stuff, but the rural neglect, is that you can also, like, success, you can have partial successes while the major problem is unaddressed, right? Like, I think the intelligences have actually done a good job in recent years of neutralizing Boko Haram cells that have tried to expand out, you know, not all of them, but, like, there have been counterterrorism successes. But, you know, that's only one part of the puzzle, right? You can look at that, and it's a very important part of the puzzle, because it's better to have the violence contained in one region than spreading out everywhere. But until you address the kind of deeper causes, right, like the DSS can be doing as much as it's doing to try to, you know, arrest agents and sleeper cells when they move out and stuff. But if you don't have enough resources in the security sector as a whole, if you don't have governance in the rural areas and all that stuff, you're not going to be able to actually really kind of fully clear out, you know, the insurgents from their, you know, from their enclave and stuff. You're not going to be able to address that. So,
Well, James, thank you very much for this very rich insight. I'm sure this is cleared some of that complex, because it was becoming so muddy, and, you know, complex, these different groups. But you've done a very good job in providing, one, the topography of where these conflicts are happening, and also separating, you know, Western Niger, Niger, and, you know, the forest, and, you know, the Benin, and how well this group are operating, and also how they collaborate. So I'm very grateful to have you. You're now the most the BNM guest. Really grateful. I'll call you shortly on WhatsApp. But very, very grateful. Thank you very much for your time.
And thanks so much, Michael. Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you very much for tuning in to this week's episode, and I would like to implore you to join me in specially thanking our guest James Barnett, who I think has appeared 3 times now to provide very, as usual, incisive and insightful comments and rich insight into, on this occasion, the landscape of jihadist violence in Nigeria. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.